R22 Tout Monde, antenne École du Magasin, Take You There Radio.
Ayar bu savunma hayat hayaletle iyi. İpsu savahne aspual tuadır aragergo. Veri la vihkida konçun mi overa evendar. Firinden dier dieniak fata saisaia ulsksasie. Aime fubau. Ekel bewer mis memien de ambrumbien solep de feminisau pilis lemen.
Bow in a quet ike no tie, erbni, quet easy.
Septu talsi. Ranelin stiresias. Fobre. Esse conra biteven. Sirato merabi. Ristì odiasive serno peluti.
Thank you for being with us and accepting this invitation. We've just listened to a sound element from an installation you did, which is called Don't Trip Over the Wire. And this was a larger spatial installation, actually, and you were working on this piece while you were in residency at La Friche in Marseille last year, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. So what we heard is there's a voice, and this voice seems to be speaking words. But there's also music, some sounds, and can you tell us how this sound piece came together? What was the inspiration behind it?
I did this piece actually for the Edinburgh Art Festival last year, so in July, and it was at Collective Gallery, and there was something quite special for me when I visited the spot where it was going to be shown. It was on the top of Carlton Hill, which is a mountain, and when you get there, you have the view of the city, and you have this amazing view of this North Sea, and then there's this giant replica of the Parthenon, and it's quite overwhelming when you're up there. And in the gallery is a temporary art space, and when you walk in, the way that they made it is that they made a giant window, so basically you're in the space and all you want to look at is really outside.
Okay.
So I had never worked with sound before, but when I went into the space, for me, it was not possible to make any objects. And the plan since before was to work with the with my research on the writer Louis Wolfson, who I've been working with for 1 year at that time, and I just thought that it had to be some sound which would make sense somehow in a way, because my work has always been dealing with language, and I thought that at some point it would definitely go in this area where it would be it would be manifesting itself into words or sound. So I wanted to work with he invented a translation process. Actually, maybe I should give a little bit more history on him and who he is.
Yes, okay. I mean, yes.
That would be good. Yeah. So he's an American writer. He was living in New York, and he wrote a book called Le Schizo et les Langues, and that book was sent by him to Gallimard in 1967. In his book, he describes, the book was written in French, and he describes his basically his hatred for the English language and how he invented a system to annihilate it. So at first he invented a kind of a system that was a stethoscope that was plugged into a radio. Mm-hmm. So it was easy for him to access this because he was often in psychiatric hospital because he was a schizophrenic. And so then he could not hear the people around him to speak. And then after, he was not satisfied by that because, of course, it was a one-way thing. He could not hear, but then he could not communicate. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be able to also communicate and respond to his world. So then he invented a language that was a combination of Russian, Hebrew, French, and German. And then he would simultaneously translate the words that he would hear into this combination of languages, and then he would be able to not hear English.
Okay, so it's a mode of deconstruction, actually. Somewhere, just to add something on what you just said, somewhere I read that this system you described, that he started out by using a stethoscope with a radio just to physically block all the sounds that were surrounding him, which were of English language, of course. And
yeah.
Somewhere I read that he used to tune into radio stations in foreign languages.
Yes.
Which were frequently French or German, and it made me think that probably that experience might have been at the source of what he did later, using those same languages plus Hebrew and Russian, of course, to sort of phonetically deconstruct every English word.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing about this also is that he invented this system in the 60s, so he claims that he invented the Walkman before everybody. Okay. So, which is kind of like a funny, a funny thing. But so I wanted to do something with his system and with the idea of the importance also of music in his life, because it was something that he would block also, that he would use to block his surroundings and block what would be around him. For me, it was important to do something with sound and with music. And music was also, somehow the language of music was a language that I did not know. It was a language that I was foreign in. And that was also something that was quite nice for me. And I had, since a really early age, I've been always a big fan of there's these records of music by Ennio Morricone, early Ennio Morricone, where he used a singer, she's an opera singer called Edda del Orso, mm-hmm. and all these records were made using a voice without any lyrics, so it's just basically syllables, but somehow there's an image that's conveyed through the song, and that was something that I had liked since a very long time, and I had the idea to use Wolfson's translation process, or part of it anyway, in which he isolates a lot of consonants, and to create a text using this process. And then the plan was to also create a score, like a visual score, that was not a conventional score, because of course I don't know how to put anything on a portée. So for me, it was just to make a series of drawings. Also, I was looking a lot at Cornelius Cardew's scores and even John Cage's, which are more like drawings. And so the idea was to create this score and this text in parallel, and then give this text and this score to a musician and a singer. And then to each step in the creation of the piece, there would be a kind of loss of information, because I would lose a bit of my, it would be not more my possession anymore. And then the person that would take it would reappropriate it using their own understanding and their own language, and then create something new with it, and then send it to me again. So first what I did is I sent this visual score to the musician, who is a Montreal musician called Philippe Lozier. And then the idea was that he was going to create a universe, a kind of musical element with the drawings. And then he sent this back to me, and it was like a one-shot thing. So I was not able to change anything. And then the same thing was done with a singer called Erika Angel, who is originally Swedish. And so she got the text, and then she had to appropriate it in her own way, and then sing it to the music. And then everything was sent back to me, and then it was the result of the communication and the kind of exchange between us.
So if I understand correctly, this is something you wrote based on Louis Wolfson's methods using consonants. A text you wrote was simultaneously translated by two people. One person who translates it into musical notation, and another one that interprets it as into music with her voice.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, but also the musician had to base his composition on a series of drawings that were a system of notation that was invented by me. Okay. So it was not a conventional system of notation, because I don't have any repère for doing that. So it was mostly the drawings that I invented were going to make him compose something. So it was a new system of notation that he had to adapt and to re-encode in some way.
Okay, so this is like a graphical notation, which is, if I'm not wrong, quite open to interpretation, as you just said. It's like from one person to the other, there's a it's not just translation, but it's a whole new interpretation. It's probably open to improvisation on many different levels also.
Yeah, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, the idea is also that there's a certain, there's something lost, and then there's something born again. Okay. So I have a certain feeling of estrangement to something that I've already created. And I think that's something that's recurring in my practice, that there's always this moment where I lose a bit control over what I've created, whether it's like an object or a text or, in this case, the sound work.
Mm-hmm. I see. It's very interesting. This makes me think of this idea of synesthesia, you know, this idea of a sort of a universal correspondence between shapes, sounds, and meanings. You know, it's a very idealistic idea, but I came across it when I was reading a little bit about linguistics, and it's also very present in linguistic theory. For example, if you go back to the shape of letters, like how, like, O, yes, omega, and, you know, there's a roundness to it, and how these things can sometimes be universal. And I don't know, it's it makes me think about this comparative and sort of synesthetic relationship between maybe, you know, shapes, spaces, sounds and meanings in a way.
Yeah, it's even supposed to be that if you ask a lot of people which color should have a letter, they would often, like 80% of the time, would say that the letter A would be red and the letter I would be yellow. And there's this, like, I guess, universal kind of idea of how things would supposed to be. But I think for me, the relationship to objects and how I see my installations anyway, and the relationship between the objects and the sound work and the, in some cases, drawings, I think it's like I want to create this universe that is a bit, it's like it's a feeling of a home. It's like an inhabited space of language. For me, it's a space that I want to create and inhabit so I can be protected somehow. And in that matter, most of my work comes from this book that I wrote.
Okay, I wanted to go back to this, actually. I have the book in my hands.
Yes.
Would you allow me to...
Perfect.
Yeah, no, would you allow me to read this sequence from the book? It's called The Twofold Room.
Yes.
And this is a sequence which is printed on the cover of the book, but I think it really is about what you just said. I'm just going to read it and then maybe we can discuss a little bit about it. So here I go. If space begins with words, then can I say that we inhabit language? And if the words I use, signs traced on the blank page, syllables spoken, describing, framing, and naming this space, are the words of others, if they are someone else's before they are mine, simultaneously so familiar and so foreign, then can I say that we live in this space as transients, that the space we live in is a borrowed space? Language is a sojourn, a stay in a hotel. So this is how you begin the book, actually.
Yes!
And if I'm not wrong, I read somewhere that this book, it's while working on this book that you actually came across Lewis Wolfson's work as well. And I read it a couple of times. And just to make a short introduction, I was really amazed by how you build on all these references of linguistic theory, semantics, semiology, and so on. So everything that revolves around language. But at the same time, you really go into also a spatial exploration. And for example, you have references in the book which come from like hotel architecture, you know, avant-garde hotel architecture, and
yeah,
then some studies about the hotel lobby as a social space. You know, you build upon all these references that sort of unite a thinking about language and meaning, but also space and the social use of space, etc. So I was really, that I think was really amazing. Can you speak about how this book came alive?
Yeah, for sure. This book I wrote, it actually, I was living in Glasgow. It was my third year there. And so as you can tell probably from what I'm speaking, I'm originally French, but I'm actually originally French-Canadian, so I'm from Montreal. Yeah. So I've grown up bilingual. Of course, my mother tongue is French, though. But I moved to Glasgow to do my MFA in 2010. And what happened basically is I stopped speaking French. I started to lose it somehow. Mm. I was not reading it anymore, I was not speaking it anymore, and I started dreaming in English, and I started to feel like I was losing something that was mine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a strange feeling. And yet the language that I was using all the time, which was English, was not feeling like it was mine at all, because it's not something that I was born with, I guess. It's not inherent in me. It's not... So I was feeling a bit divided. I was feeling in a state of in-between. And I started to reflect on the idea of language as something that's yours, but not completely, that you can actually lose. And it was also important for me, the idea of home, which I was saying before. And for me, I just started to think that the language was like a hotel. It was like a space that you inhabit, but that's never yours, that you try to make yours. Like, you can go in the hotel room and you can try to remove the frame that's quite ugly and to put your clothes in the drawer and to, you know, make it your home, but it's not yours completely. So I just started to research linguistics theory, and there was something really funny because a lot of examples were talking about building, about a concrete space, about building a space, about bricks and stone, and for me it was even more obvious that this metaphor of the building to describe language was perfect, actually. And so I just decided that I would like to use the space to, and each little aspect of the space, like the lobby, the carpet, the hallway, and the bedroom, to describe different sections of how I would see language. So, and for me, the hotel was also an extremely rich space because it has such a history of writers living in hotels to write, or such a history of stories taking place in a hotel. It's such a rich space. I mean, it just allowed for so much to take place.
Yeah, this is lovely. This also brings me to maybe mention something I noticed while doing this research and this series of interviews, is that building, this metaphor of building that you just mentioned, does come very frequently in linguistic theory. I mean, there's one in your book of Wittgenstein, for example, this A and B and bricks and pillars and so on. But I've also, like, maybe in a more experiential mode, I'm going to speak about the myth of Babel in a way, because, you know, the whole idea of, you know, a human race that speaks a single language becomes capable of suddenly building this incredible tower and reaching the level of God, you know. There's this sort of symbolic thing with language and building, in a way, that comes from that myth, I guess. But one of the other cases that I studied was, for example, I will just give this example, but it was this Walla Walla language in Congo, which is invented in construction sites because workers, you know, working physically to build, you know, infrastructure, buildings, you know, housing, etc. And this situation of working together, you know, possibly enables them to create a new language. So I've been thinking a lot about this idea of this link between building and language. It's really recurrent. It's a recurrent theme.
I mean, there's something about that's, I think, the citation that I use, like, building by taking several small elements and then making something that's a whole, and then slowly through communication between people and through time. And it's quite funny because I finished the book and then I thought that the most, like you just mentioned, the most used and quite obvious reference to language and a building is Babel, and nowhere in the book do I use it. I actually realized that when I finished it, and I thought that was quite strange that it was omitted from the...
it's interesting for you, because you mentioned that you will keep working with Louis Wolfson, with whom you are also in touch, corresponding, if I'm not wrong. What's the next step? What's happening next for you?
So I'm actually, like you said, I'm corresponding with him, and now I'm learning German, which he's very excited about. So now our whole conversation has switch to German, because before we were speaking in French. And I'm actually doing a series of workshops on Louis Wolfson. I did one in Luzern in Switzerland. I'm going to do one in Montreal in the fall. And I'm actually working on a book So I've invited, I think it's 8 or 9 artists to respond to Louis Wolfson. All artists that work with language in such a in a one way or the other. So they were all respond to his, I guess, translation process or ideas that is vehiculated in his book. And so we will make a publication on him in collaboration with Trian France, and then this will also become an exhibition that will be in Montreal, hopefully in the fall. It's to be confirmed, but yeah, that's
okay. That sounds great.
Yeah, and then there's also, I should let you know, because there's this Italian filmmaker called Duccio Fabbri, and he actually, Louis Wolfson himself told me this, that he did a documentary on him, and I think that it should be finished shooting soon. And it should be, it's a quite high budget documentary where he actually went to see him in Puerto Rico, and he filmed him now. I think he's probably 87. And there's a reenactment of his life when he was young. So it's like a bit, not romanticized, but yeah, there's like a reenactment of his life, and there's actually scenes of him and where he lives, and I think it should come out sometime, if not in 2015, at the beginning of 2016. So that should be interesting, because the thing with Louis Wolfson is that he's a bit unknown into an English-speaking world, if I could say, because obviously, because of the impossibility to translate in English his work. So he was mostly...
Sounds like something he wouldn't necessarily enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's impossible in a way to translate his work. So, I mean, even post-mortem, it would be like a kind of Trahison for him. So
Yes. Exactly.
But he allowed this filmmaker, I think he's much more chill now about not speaking English anymore. But yeah, I think it would be great, because it will open his approach and his amazing process to English speaking community, and I think that would be really great.
Yeah, well, thank you for giving all this information. We'll be following the documentary and also your work, and I'm really curious to know what will come out in this book and the exhibition project you just mentioned.
Yeah, merci. Me too.